From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Claire Wiley, and this morning we are going to first speak with Betsy Howell, who is an author and longtime employee of the United States Forest Service. She has recently penned Wild Forest Home, Stories of the Conservation in the Pacific Northwest. The 25 essays in her book chronicle Howell's more than three-decade career studying wildlife in Oregon and Washington. Betsy, thanks so much for being a part of the show today.
Well, thank you so much, Claire, for having me. It's a real honor.
Well, we are thrilled to have you on the show, and I want to begin our conversation with getting to know a little bit more about you, an introduction actually to Betsy, and what first led you on the path of conservation, and then maybe what was that pivotal moment in your life that had you pursue work in wildlife conservation? Was it something that you always knew as a child, or was there one moment in your life that took you on that path?
Right. Well, great question. I did always want to know, I always knew as a child that I really wanted to work in wildlife conservation. And I think that came when I was very young and I first read the Born Free series by Joy Adamson. If people remember those, she wrote a series of books about her relationship with a lioness in Kenya in the 1950s. And I was just in awe of that story and her connection with this one animal. And I thought I would always grow up and go to Africa and work with lions and other wildlife. And I did make it over there for a couple of different trips, but my path always brought me back to the Northwest where I've grown up. And I went to college in Eastern Washington. I got a degree in wildlife management, and I just always knew this was what I wanted to do, and was fortunate enough to get a position one summer during my college years with the Forest Service in Oregon. And that's pretty much been my career ever since.
Well, we both share our love then for that series of books and having it ignite something inside of us. I also have a very much of a close relationship and a love for Africa and the wildlife there. So you begin this journey through college and you started your career researching specifically, if I'm correct, the northern spotted owl. Can you tell us about this and why this owl is an indicator or umbrella species for that area of our nation?
Yeah, so I started surveying for northern spotted owls like many of my colleagues to come did as well in 1986. And this was about 4 years before the owl was federally listed on the Endangered Species Act. And there was researchers and a number of different people had been investigating the owl's role in Northwest forests and their dependence on these ecosystems since the early 70s. But I think it was, you know, in the early to mid 80s, it was really becoming a much more of an issue for sort of everyday Forest Service employees. So a lot of people were starting to work on this, and including myself, I began as a volunteer with the Mount Hood National Forest east of Portland, Oregon. And yeah, owls were, excuse me, were looked at kind of as an umbrella species. They typically need quite a large area of forest. They're very much diet specialists. So that typically means you need a larger area to find the preferred food as opposed to a species that is more of a generalist and can take advantage of different prey in a smaller area. So northern spotted owls needed a large area. If those areas were intact and functioning, then they would, you know, cover the requirements for a number of different species. So they did certainly become a focal point for a lot of conservation work in the Northwest.
And out of curiosity, starting your work with this in 1986 as an indicator species, what have you seen with the northern spotted owl over the years or decades? Is it adaptable to climate change, or are you seeing large impacts on this species because of it? Or what are some of the things maybe you've seen over that span of 3 decades?
Right. Well, I have 3 essays in the book specifically about spotted owls and how things have changed for them just in terms of the circumstances out there in the forest. So they're facing a number of different threats. In 1994, the Northwest Forest Plan came into being that covered federal forest management within the range of the northern spotted owls. So that was in Washington, Oregon, and Northern California. And it went quite a long way to protecting and developing older forests in those areas, which has been really quite important to not only owls, but to a number of different species. The Northwest Forest Plan really tried to address things from a larger, broader ecosystem approach. But other things are always happening, right? So one of them is that there's now this very serious threat coming from the barred owl, which has in the last several decades become a very prominent presence in these forests, as well as lots of different habitats in the Northwest. So in contrast to the spotted owl, the barred owl is a generalist. They can take advantage of a lot of different kinds of prey. They are very adaptable to a lot of different kinds of habitats. They're more aggressive. So in the early years, after the spotted owl was listed, habitat loss was the biggest concern, and now it's recognized that the barred owl is a very grave threat. So things have really changed on the landscape, and as well as with the technology to learn about spotted owls and to document them where they still are.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that. You had alluded to that you had placed these spotted owls as part of the essays in your book, and I presumably would think that a lot of these essays may be derived from field notes that you took while you were on the job and then maybe began crafting them in more depth as essays. Is that how this process began? Was it from your field notes, or what had you start writing a little bit more in depth about these different attributes of the forest?
Yes, the essays did come out of a kind of, I suppose, 3 different sources. One was field notes for sure, and as well as journals that I kept. And I began keeping a journal the summer I volunteered in 1986. And I kind of, I went back to school, I finished my undergraduate degree, and the journals kind of got a little spotty here and there, but I always continued with them. So I had those, and then my memory, as well as other people's input into some of these stories too. So that was also very helpful. And I actually left the Forest Service in the late 90s for about 6 years because I wanted to become a writer. And that was when I really started putting together these notes and journal entries in story form and trying to incorporate, both my experiences and something about the species, along with some history and along with the changing technology, which has been really quite extraordinary, not only for surveying and documenting spotted owls, but also for forest carnivores, which I've done a lot of, and there are a few essays about them as well, using remote camera technology. It's really quite amazing how things have changed over the past couple of decades.
I love that you began this career in wildlife conservation. You work with the U.S. Forest Service. You take a little bit of a hiatus to work on a craft that's important to you. Then you come back to the Forest Service, but then you marry the two, and they both serve you well, because obviously this book is so well written and so wonderful, and you feel like you're a part of it. And you're talking to some of the ways technology has affected field work or affected the work that you do, and cameras specifically you just mentioned. Can you tell us how much that has changed over the course of the last three decades?
Oh, I would be glad to. I kind of love telling this story. So in 1991, some information came across my desk at the Ranger District where I was working at that time about how to set up a remote camera design to photograph forest carnivores, which are pretty hard to detect. They're obviously very secretive. They're often quite silent. In Northwest forests, it's not very easy to find their tracks necessarily due to all the needles and material on the ground. So this information came to me, and it involved using one of these old 110 Instamatic cameras, mm-hmm. for people who might remember those, with the old flash tower. Yeah. And there was a coat hanger involved and some string attached to a piece of bait. And when the animal would pull on the bait, the coat hanger would come down and depress the shutter button, so it would take a photo. And it did work. The issue was that it would only take one photo at a time, so you had to go back out and advance that advance it to the next photo. So it was pretty labor intensive, and it took a long time to get results. By contrast, these days, of course, we have digital cameras. You can have a 32-gigabyte memory card in the camera that can take, 40,000 or more photos. So it's amazing. And also the way to attract carnivores to the site has really changed a lot in terms of the kind of bait we can use. And with lithium batteries, you can have cameras out in the forest for up to a year. They'll keep working so that you don't need to keep going and, maintaining the site, which can be really difficult through the winter when it's best to survey for carnivores, but it's also the most difficult from a safety standpoint, getting people out there. So things have really advanced a lot in the camera world.
Yeah, it is amazing. And how the cameras are set up, there's a little more camouflaging, not so much, the MacGyvered way of, like you said, baiting them. I helped with a local organization here to go check the cameras in a forested area. And it's wild what can be captured now, and the stories that maybe you can tell more about behavior of the animals in those captured images, probably more so than before, I would assume.
Oh, I think so. Yes. I feel like there's always going to be a lot that we don't know, of course, but our ability to really understand much better what's happening on the landscape, not only through cameras, but through other ways of gathering information that are far less invasive to an animal. They often don't involve, capturing an animal at all, like the cameras. We can definitely get a much better picture of species presence. Doesn't necessarily give a species absence, because there are lots of reasons why you might not document an animal and they can still be there. But we can understand a lot better when they are there, how they're interacting with other taxa. It's exciting, and it's still leaves us with many questions, I think.
Oh yeah, it probably poses more questions. And in
Yes.
staying in the technology vein, I want to talk about DNA and how you can tell a story now in areas with DNA because of new technology. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. In recent years, on the Olympic National Forest, and a lot of forests are doing this too, and other lands. We've done eDNA sampling at lakes and ponds, trying to get a better picture of what native fish and amphibians are in these areas. And one of the reasons we're so interested in this is that a lot of places have been stocked in the last century with non-native fish, and these can have a pretty big impact on native species. And one of the questions is just how is that intersecting with effects from a changing climate, which can often dry out ponds at high elevations. So between non-native fish and climate change, the impacts can be pretty big, particularly for amphibians. So the eDNA process is pretty simple. You collect water from different points along a water body, and then you run it through a filter, excuse me, and collect any kind of DNA material that might be in the water. So, from shed skin, from saliva, from other excretions, skin, anything like that. And then run it through a process in a laboratory, and you can and match it to species that they have in a reference library of DNA. And so this has been really great. Again, you're not capturing the animals, you're not stressing anybody out, but you're getting information on who is potentially in the lake. Now, you have to think about, kind of some of the caveats here too. And some of the interesting things we found was that, and other people, of course, have observed this too, fish move around a lot more in a lake, say, and will shed more DNA in a wider area. Some amphibians don't move around very much, so it could be a little hit or miss if we document them. And occasionally we would observe the animals, but we wouldn't, they wouldn't come up in the DNA samples. So I think the visual encounter surveys are important to couple with the eDNA sampling.
Yeah, it seems that you don't want to lose that contact either. Or I would think going out there in the 80s and the 90s and really maybe having an understanding of what's beneath your feet, the areas that you're treading on and what's happening, there's got to be a lot to be said as a scientist about being there in the moment and also taking it in.
Oh, absolutely. I think being out in these wild habitats and actually taking notes, observing, is kind of it's kind of the foundation, I think, right, of wildlife conservation and science. And then we have all these amazing tools at our disposal now too, that are, as we've talked about, allowing us to see more and understand things better than ever, but they can't be a complete substitute for actually being on the ground.
Absolutely. And we've talked a lot about rewilding on our show, and I understand that you helped to monitor fishers and reintroduce them into the Olympic Peninsula. Can you talk about your work with fishers, what they are, and why that was important for that ecosystem?
Sure. Yeah, the Fisher Project has been a wonderful event here on the peninsula. So, fishers are a small member of the mustelid family, or the weasel family. They are about 4 to 15 pounds in size. The males are substantially larger than the females, so that's why that's such a large range. This is the same family with the wolverine, mink, otter, badger, those kinds of animals. So they're very feisty and very resourceful little creatures, but they had been extirpated from Washington State in the 20th century. After a lot of work planning and environmental assessment and analysis, it was determined to begin a reintroduction program in the state. And there were three areas where the animals were going to be reintroduced, two in the Cascade Range and then the Olympic Mountains. And the Olympic Mountains were selected to be the first place to bring the animals back because it was felt it had a very good chunk of intact, contiguous, suitable habitat, largely made up of Olympic National Park. And then the Olympic National Forest, where I work, is kind of around the park. And then there's other state and private land around that on the peninsula. So the fishers came from British Columbia, and a total of 90 were brought back or were brought here in between 2008 and 2010. And then I along with as a Forest Service employee, worked with the Park Service, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, other nonprofits to monitor the fishers and document denning and reproductive success movements. And we set up a lot of cameras and monitored them strictly with cameras from 2013 to 2016, and then have been kind of collecting incidental information since then. But the idea has always been actually to have another monitoring period as well to see how they're doing. So one of the reasons this was so important is that fishers were one of two species not here on the peninsula anymore due to impacts from people. And the other one, of course, is the wolf. But now we've got one of them back. So they're an important part of the ecosystem as a small carnivore.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we were just reading about an area of the Amazon that they have discovered new species and new things that haven't been documented before. I wonder if you have some of those also in the Pacific Northwest, if there's species that you haven't discovered yet, or are we just at a stage where we're looking back and seeing what's missing or what was there once and isn't there and trying to replenish?
Great question. Well, I think maybe it's kind of both. I think there have to be species out there that we don't know about. Now, if they're really large ones or not, I don't know about that. But certainly, the smaller invertebrates, insects, maybe others too. Definitely, there are things we don't know about. But I think it's also kind of a retrospective look too, and trying to make sure ecosystems are functioning as completely and as successfully as they can. And I think that's, that's my take on what the job of land managers is to make sure that those are functioning as well as possible, these ecosystems. And to do that, you just really need the complement of species that were there, naturally. And one of the essays in the book is about the Encetina salamander, which I think is a really great example of an animal that has a huge impact in the forest, in terms of carbon cycling. And this is something that has not been really well known, I think, among the general public. But in recent decades, researchers have really learned a lot about Ensetina salamanders, and they're really crucial. So it kind of just goes to show that every resident is really important and has a role.
Well, I think that's one of the biggest takeaways from your writings and your essays is that everything matters and these studies matter and conservation matters. And what do you want people to take away? We've got just like 1 minute left, but what do you want people to take away from your writings?
Well, thanks so much, Claire. That's very, very nice. And I think, I've told people that if I had to sum up the book in just one word, it would be community. And I think that's what I suppose I would like people to take away from the work, which is just that, it's not only about the community of full-time forest residents, but also about the community that we all are a part of, say like your work there with some of the camera volunteer projects. The research scientists, the land managers, the volunteers, the citizen scientists, we all have a role to play. And as a community, I think we can really do a lot of great conservation and help our troubled earth, basically.
Well, Betsy, we appreciate you. This is Betsy Howell, who is the author and longtime employee of the United States Forest Service. She wrote Wild Forest Home: Stories of Conservation in the Pacific Northwest. Thanks for joining us today on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much, Claire.
And welcome back. This is This Green Earth right here on KPCW. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us next is author Erica Hauser, who has written a book. The latest is The Age of Deer: Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. Erica, thank you so much for joining us here on This Green Earth.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, Erica, you are an author and a more poetic one at that, and you have done some poetry, but you've written a few books prior to this. How did you arrive on this topic in particular? Why choose deer?
Well, I have been interested for a long time in questions about what we call nature and what we mean by that when we say nature or we say that something is natural. It gets into questions about, who humans are on the planet and how we relate to the earth and how we draw these lines between kind of the human world and everything else, which we tend to label as nature. And it just occurred to me at some point about 4 or 5 years ago that to ask those questions, deer would be a really great topic, a really good lens for looking at those questions because they are very intertwined with the human world, both through history and also very much in our world now.
Yeah, so deer, I'm guessing, are probably on nearly every continent on the planet. So they're quite ubiquitous to the globe.
Yeah, I believe Africa doesn't have any native deer species. It's antelope that kind of fill that niche in Africa. And I believe the same thing is true in Australia. But it is definitely true that for a lot of humans through a lot of years, deer have been an important native local animal, and they still are.
Yeah. Right. I mean, you can go back to some of the first cave paintings, of many of which include deer as part of their paintings. And out west here, pictographs or petroglyphs or so include deer not only as the animal but as part of a iconography. As part of the cultural ceremonial aspects, and we can get a little more into that.
I would love to dive into that now. Yeah. The history that you went into around the deer, mythologically, all of that. Let's get into it.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that to be such a rich, kind of trove of myths and stories and art, but it really is. You know, I thought I might find a few colorful, you know, folk tales about deer. But when I started to research that, I realized that they're kind of a major topic for human storytellers and art makers going back thousands of years. You know, you referenced the cave paintings, and some of the biggest cave galleries in Europe, places like Lascaux and Altamira. Of all the paintings in those galleries, deer are one of the four most frequently depicted subjects. So that really tells you something about their importance at that time to people, and the, you know, esteem that they were held in. And it really continues, you know, throughout the centuries. There are just lots and lots of very beautiful, fascinating indigenous stories about deer, and lots of places where they turn up in modern art, and, you know, pretty much every era of art history you can find them.
Well, yeah, it seems that they ride this line between almost domestication and wildness, because we have this really true coexistence with this animal.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons that the topic, you know, kind of showed itself to me was that it occurred to me that, and it's a little different where you guys are out west, but in a lot of the United States, if you're thinking about large wild animals that you might see in your daily life, you know, not that you would get an occasional exciting glimpse, but animals that you can kind of count on seeing in daily life, for a lot of us, that's deer, period. You know, where I live, I might occasionally get to see a bear, and it's very exciting, but I'm not going to see them week in and week out like I do with deer. And so, you know, there's something very fascinating about that, that there's at least one big, charismatic, beautiful, wild animal that's kind of our neighbor, you know, that lives close to us and happens to be good at thriving even in cities and towns and suburbs. So that really makes them a very intimate part of our world.
That's true, because well, of course, here in Park City there's deer all around in our backyards all times of the day. Mm-hmm. We may come upon them, but yet every time I see one, I am
I stop
what I'm doing, and I just like mm-hmm. Wow, that is a particularly now some of the young bucks that are around, they are a stunning looking, beautiful animal, but they can, because of that adaptability, you know, we're kind of focused on the kinship. Let's talk a little bit about the trouble in your as part of your title. What would you say are some of the troubles or challenges that we have with deer?
Yeah, there are a few very very definite ones, and I do think that, you know, neighbors is a useful way to think about deer, because just like with human neighbors, you know, we like having neighbors and we appreciate them and we rely on them sometimes, but sometimes we get in each other's way mm-hmm. too, or we annoy each other or cause problems. And that is definitely true with deer. You know, one of the big issues is vehicle collisions. And so the more roads we build and the more traveling we're accustomed to doing on those roads, you know, there are more and more opportunities for cars and deer to come into contact in a way that's dangerous for everybody involved. The transmission of Lyme disease is another issue that, you know, people have strong feelings about. Ticks are, they feed on deer during a particular part of their life cycle. It's not exactly true to say that deer transmit Lyme disease to people, but they are part of that tick life cycle that can end with a person contracting Lyme disease. And another big issue would be the fact that deer eat plants, and some of those plants we consider to be our plants, mm-hmm. whether those are agricultural crops or, you know, more like backyard ornamental plants or your veggie garden. You know, many, many of us have had that experience, and I write about that in the book. I'm a gardener, so I know that feeling of trying to keep the deer out and defend my garden against them and the sort of frustration that happens when they get through my fence and eat my stuff. So those are some of the major conflicts that can arise.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, with all of those, it seems like some of them maybe come down to human tolerance versus this natural balance.
Our adaptability.
Deer and yeah. Our adaptability to wildlife. And we seem to always think that everything needs to adapt around us. And I'm curious about, you know, some of these themes that you talk about as far as how humans control wildlife, and in particular, how humans feel like you hear these terms of deer overpopulation and we need to control the population. And then we talk about natural balance and the balance of nature. So are we stepping in and taking control over this natural balance, or is there such a thing as this idealistic natural balance?
Well, that's one of the places where my research for the book really took me down a major rabbit hole that I hadn't really anticipated. That is an incredibly complex question, and it gets to the history of science and, you know, changing ideas over the last few centuries about how the world, the natural world, is supposed to work and what is our place in it. And it's just a very, very unsettled question. And then, you know, meanwhile, in real life on the ground, you have kind of local governments, or sometimes it's even, you know, like a neighborhood homeowners association that is just trying to make a practical decision right now about, should we do something to control our local deer population? Because we're having some of those problems that I mentioned, you know, vehicle crashes and landscaping damage and things like that. And those decisions become very wrenching and emotional in a lot of cases, because those underlying ideas about the balance of nature are really so unsettled. And for a lot of people, very unexamined. You know, I think we just walk around assuming that there is something called the balance of nature. And actually, that's a pretty open question. And the question of how many deer or a habitat is the right number, that's also kind of unsettled in the scientific world. And so there's just a lot of ambiguity about it. And that was something that I hadn't realized until I really started to probe that. It made me appreciate how difficult it is for folks on the ground to make those decisions.
Well, growing up in a area in the Midwest where people did hunt deer, and it wasn't part of innately something that I would have chosen or wanted to see or talk about or do, but it was around me, and I would at times hear, well, we do this because the winters will be very harsh on them if they are overpopulated and not all of them will survive. Is there truth to that, or was that just a way for us to make ourselves feel better
or justify hunting permits,
the hunting, now that, you know, I think in earlier days there was a need for food, and we obviously used their skins, and it was more of a need, and now it's not so much need based. So are we creating these reasons to justify this?
Well, you know, again, that's just such a fascinating, complex issue that you raise. I mean, I think there's still a place definitely for hunting in our world now, even though we can obviously go to the grocery store and buy meat if that's what mm-hmm. we want to eat. But I think hunting can be a way for people to have a seasonal, a very local, and in a lot of cases, a very conscious relationship to the land where they live. And I think that's a good thing, that, you know, in general, we need more of that. We need folks to have those relationships with their habitat. And hunting can be a way to become very deeply attuned to the place where you live. It's true that, you know, if there's not some sort of predator, then a prey animal like deer those populations are going to suffer from disease, maybe from harsh winters.
Right.
So there is some truth to that. I think one of the missing pieces here is, the other part of the history is that in many, many places in the U.S., we've removed the large predators. So that's a major intervention into the ecology and the landscape that is the framework for this whole conversation. We've taken away the wolves, the mountain lions, again, not everywhere. And you guys are, probably living in closer proximity to big predators than I am here in Virginia. Mm-hmm. But that's a really important factor that sometimes people forget. And so by taking away those kind of animal managers of deer, we've left ourselves with the job of managing deer.
Mm. We are speaking with author Erica Hauser, who just wrote The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. And we're talking about, tapping into some of that hunting. And you did bring up a very important point that we have also moved out some of these larger predators at the outskirts. So where we are living now, deer are probably populating a little bit more due to that. But I want to get back to the hunting and these thought processes that we have around it, because I think when you think of deer, Chris touched on this, most of us stop. Their physicality, their beauty, their sweetness. I think a lot of the their quietness.
Unassuming.
Yeah, and a lot of times
athletic.
In films as well, deer are representative of something auspicious, or they're ethereal, or they represent innocence. And that gets me to, a movie like Bambi, even in a cartoon. I think we often think about them as these very sweet creatures that should be protected and kept. How does all of that affect our relationship with deer or hunters?
Well, I think, Bambi, just to take one example that you raised, has been it's got to be one of the most influential films of the last century. I mean, that movie is almost 80 years old now, and it is still a major influence on American culture. If you follow deer in the news, which I've been doing now for several years, you will see that many, many news stories that involve deer will use the word Bambi to refer to the deer, which is a really interesting thing. There's not too many animals that we refer to by the name of a character that they inspired in a specific film. And of course, Bambi in the film, we think of as a baby, an orphaned baby, who kind of suffers, the worst trauma you can imagine, losing the mother. And so we think of him as a victim and sort of young and helpless and vulnerable and innocent and all these things. And all of that definitely gets transferred onto our notion of deer in general. The film also shows hunters in a specific way. It doesn't show them up close. They're always far away, so you can't see their faces. You really have no idea who they are, what their motivations are. We just know that they kill somebody's mom and they start a forest fire. So it's a very, very negative view of hunters. And apparently when the movie came out in the 1940s, the hunting community, right away they kind of saw that this was bad for them and from a PR standpoint, and they were right. I think, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that generations of Americans have been influenced by that, to see deer as innocent and vulnerable and to see hunters as kind of evil. And of course, the reality is always so much more complex than that. Even in the movie, Bambi grows up and becomes a kind of magnificent adult and father's offspring. And we don't really think about that aspect so much, that, deer are tough and resilient and strong and magnificent. That part has been kind of minimized by the Bambi story.
Yeah, Disney has done a lot to influence our attitudes towards wildlife and nature. You can look at the opposite way and how Disney has vilified other animals too, wolves, mountain lions, seen as always predators, conniving, packs, you know, out to get you and take your children, you know, that type
of thing.
That's
when we put our
That's
own
the
human.
Disneyfication yeah. of our nature and ecosystems.
Or put our human emotions onto animals, which
yes,
we've spoken to
onto
before.
As a story.
When you're studying deer and you said you've been researching this for years, how long has that research been going on, and what are some of the things that you found that surprised you most?
Well, I started the research in 2019, and my book just came out earlier this year. I'm still following deer in the news and still learning more about them. I think one of the most surprising things I learned in terms of their history in the U.S. is that around the turn of the 20th century, deer had been overhunted to the point where they were nearly wiped out. So there were entire states in the U.S. that had no deer at all. Hmm. For example, the state where I live, Virginia, there were some isolated deer populations kind of hanging on in the places where humans don't generally live. Like in the eastern part of the state, we have these very big wetlands, swamps. There were some deer kind of hanging on there, and then also up in the mountains. But it's just so hard for us to imagine this now, that, you know, deer had kind of been erased or subtracted from most people's daily life, because as we've been talking about, we're just so used to living with them as neighbors now. But just a few generations ago, that wasn't the case. And that was a result of, you know, several centuries of overhunting and habitat loss from the time that Europeans arrived here. And for some reason, that story just has been largely forgotten by Americans. We remember the fact that, you know, passenger pigeons were wiped out. We remember the fact that bison were nearly wiped out and then brought back. But we've really forgotten that about deer, and also the fact that part of the resurgence of deer was due to humans deliberately restocking them in, I think, about 30 different states. So that, to me, really calls into question the whole notion of kind of a wild animal or a natural phenomenon, when you realize how deeply human influence has changed the situation with deer as we now know them and take them for granted.
You know, that's a really good point, Erica, because I grew up in New Jersey, southern New Jersey, in the 60s and 70s, and to see a deer then was a rare event. And then there were conditions put in place where hunting was limited to removed of deer. Maybe there was some restocking that went on. And I'm almost sure that by the late 80s or even early 90s, an amazing study released showed that more deer were killed in 1 year by cars than by hunters. And then, so the populations just exploded to create that condition, which then more permits, hunting permits, were released to kind of, so you have this whipsaw roller coaster effect of populations. Mm-hmm. And as you say, it's really a lot to do with their resiliency and their adaptability to our environments, our suburban, exurban environments, that they are very successful in that way.
Yeah, and we don't mean to vilify hunters here either, because they can be some of our greatest conservationists as well.
In the absence of mountain lions and wolves, like Erica said, we've replaced those animals with the gun as a way of controlling populations.
Yeah.
So, sorry, Erica, we were running away with the conversation, but you make some really good points. We'll give you the last word.
Well, I am also curious, you know, we're talking a lot about the United States, and was that your particular study? But I was just in Japan mountain biking, and I saw a deer there, and you can see how they are different around the world, how they've maybe adapted, and physically they make these changes. There's also, I guess, a deer park in Japan where you can go up and feed them. It's a whole park of just deer and how humans have created almost a way to make money around these creatures. But have you studied them globally or just here in the United States?
Well, I certainly focused on the U.S. I did get to take a trip. Part of my research was in England. And so I went there mostly to witness an ancient folk dance that's been performed there in a village called Abbots Bromley for about 800 years, happens every September. And it involves the dancers wearing reindeer antlers on their heads. Mm-hmm. And it's a totally fascinating and cool tradition that I'm really lucky I got to see. But while I was in England, I also got to see live deer. And there are, I believe, 6 species of deer living in that country. Some are native, some are not. And there are different histories of them being imported to the UK for different reasons at different times. So you can go pretty deep into, you know, a study of world deer populations. I think there are over 40 species of deer in the world. So there's a lot of variety. But certainly, you know, most of the book springs from just my experience as a person living in the Eastern US and having a lot of contact and daily experiences with white-tailed deer.
Well, the name of the book is, The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. The author is Erica Hauser. Erica, do you have a website people can go to learn more about this book and your other work?
Sure. It's just ericahauser.com. There are links to the book there and some other writings. And I also made a podcast about deer, and you can find that there as well.
That's fantastic, because I think that we have them in our day-to-day lives, and I think this book opens up our minds and our thoughts around this animal that we could see here in Park City every day. But I think that you've brought in a lot of great points and a lot of interesting facts and a different way of looking at this animal that may infiltrate our daily lives. And again, maybe next time we see one and we stop in our tracks, we'll have a greater understanding of this animal, thanks to you. Mm.
Well, thanks so much for having me. I really enjoyed talking with you guys.
Thank you,
Pleasure.
Erica.
Thanks, Erica.